This is a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation.
Well, hi everyone, you've heard a bit about us. And my name's Mitch, and as we kick off, I'd like to just acknowledge that on our end, we're on the land of the Gadigal and Bidjigal people of the Eora Nation. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge that sovereignty was never ceded.
Thank you for the introduction. I'm Michelle. As Katie said, our presentation today is going to focus on the refusal of rideshare services to people who use guide dogs or other kinds of assistance animals. And just before I go further, we know that we don't have lived experience of this, Mitch and I, and we're lawyers. We work with a lot of people in the blind and vision impaired community and other people that use assistance animals. So please keep that context in mind as well. But we're going to talk about the law in Australia that prevents unlawful discrimination, what you can do if you're discriminated against, and how we can create systemic change to remove discrimination, which we think means to drastically reduce refusals. About the Public Interest Advocacy Centre where we work, PIAC is an independent, non-profit organisation that works with people and communities who are marginalised and facing disadvantage. We seek to build a fairer, stronger society by helping to change laws, policies and practices that cause injustice and inequality. Our work combines a number of things to get systemic change: legal advice and representation, specialising in test cases and strategic casework, research, analysis and policy development, and advocacy for systems change and public interest outcomes. We're also a specialist community legal centre. We actively seek at PIAC to collaborate and partner in our work to maximise the impact of our work. And importantly, as I said before, we're not a disability rights organisation. As an organisation, we have several priority areas like civil rights, climate and energy, First Nations justice, homelessness and disability rights is also a priority area for us. In all of our projects, we seek to empower the groups we work with. Our aim is to be able to use our expertise to assist to resolve issues that are identified by civil society organisations as critical. And this is this way of working is really core to how we work in the disability rights space as well. Just to give you a broad sense of the kinds of disability rights work that we do as well. So we have a leading discrimination law practice, which aims to secure equal access for people with disability to services like education, public transport, digital and emerging technologies, and housing. And we also have a project that's called A Fairer NDIS, where we work with PIC disability rights organisations to improve outcomes under the NDIS for people with disability and to ensure that the NDIS lives up to its promise of providing choice and control for participants. In relation to what we're talking about today, PIAC has a really long history of representing clients who are blind or vision impaired in claims against public transport service providers, including public and private buses, trains and taxis in relation to accessibility issues. We're going to talk about the law and legal processes today. What we're providing in this discussion is not legal, is legal information and some of our strategic thoughts. It shouldn't be considered to be legal advice, and that's really because everybody's particular case is different and the facts and circumstances of everyone's individual experiences really vary greatly. So if you do think you might have been discriminated against and you want to look at pursuing one of the actions we're talking about today, you should definitely seek legal advice. I'm going to keep talking for a bit before I hand over to Mitch. But I want to just quickly summarise what people have told PIAC about Uber and guide dog refusals. So since Uber started operating in Australia, which was in 2012, we at PIAC have received multiple reports about the discriminatory conduct of Uber drivers towards passengers with guide dogs, particularly that they're having their Uber bookings cancelled or refused once they disclose they have a dog guide. That includes where people are being told that they need to book Uber Pet or Uber Assist in order to receive a service animal that will cater to their needs. A number of dog guide handlers have told us that an informal estimate is that around one third of trips they book with Uber are cancelled once they've disclosed they have a dog guide. This makes it really difficult for dog guide handlers to reliably travel using Uber, as you will all know from first-hand experience, and we think that that conduct will amount to unlawful disability discrimination. We understand that the implications of not being able to travel using Uber are really significant. It results in hurt, distress, humiliation from discrimination, not getting to medical appointments or meetings on time, missing out on time with families and friends, and making travel altogether a more anxious experience. A little bit about Uber itself. UberX is a system, an Uber, for providing point-to-point passenger transport services through the Uber app. A passenger uses the Uber app to request a driver to pick them up from one particular location at a particular time and transport them to another particular location. It seems really sort of simple, but because we're going to be talking about the law today, we're going to really try to be specific and define exactly what it is they do. We know that Uber has specific non-discrimination and assistance animal policies, which state that a driver is required to comply with their legal obligations to accept riders with assistance animals, such as dog guides, including on UberX. We know that many people will, when they are refused an UberX service or Uber service because they have a dog guide, make a complaint directly to Uber or possibly the state regulatory bodies that govern taxis. The evidence we have seen, and Mitch is going to talk about this in a bit more detail, suggests that in many instances Uber has not taken steps to investigate and or impose conditions on drivers in accordance with its own policies or has done so inconsistently. And I also just wanted to add that for many years, people have told PIAC that they are being refused taxi services because of their dog guides as well. So we don't think that this problem is new in a sense, and it's not unique to Uber, but we know that there are particular concerns with the way Uber have handled the conduct.
Yeah, so we've been looking into what the legal avenues might be there, and that means we've done a bit of digging into what the specific policies that Uber has are, and some of that's been through research that you can do publicly, some of that's been through some more kind of canvassing people's experiences and trying to look into the documentation that we can get hold of. So as Michelle said, Uber has policies that say drivers need to take assistance animals. As far as we're aware, those policies are kind of global across the whole Uber network. And that's because Uber has had similar kinds of issues in other countries. It's not certainly not unique to Australia that that these sorts of issues have arisen. So to that end, Uber has some things called community guidelines, and there's a specific part of those guidelines that says drivers need to follow the law, and that includes by complying with disability discrimination legislation and providing services to people with assistance animals. And it also includes things that are written into various contracts and other policy documents for drivers. So the policies say refusals shouldn't be happening, but as we know, they unfortunately still are. And I guess there's two kinds of possibilities we see for why that would be the case. One would be, well, maybe drivers don't know about the policies and the laws that apply. Or two, maybe even if they do know, the policies aren't being enforced sufficiently to make sure that they actually shape behaviour. And from what we can tell, both of those are problems. Both pieces of that are issues on the Uber side of things. So the first thing about how well drivers know about it, Uber's educational policies mean that drivers, what we understand is that drivers all need to do an education module on the app when they sign up. And then they need to show that they've got what's called proof of comprehension. That's how Uber describes it. And so from what we've heard, that basically means drivers need to, when they sign up, they watch a video that runs through those sorts of obligations. And then they do a quiz that's designed by the Australian Network on Disability. And so the quiz is sort of a few questions to make sure that they can answer correctly based on the content of the video. Now, we understand also that drivers have to do refreshers at various points. And that could be, for example, if they have a complaint against them, Uber might say, well, you've got to go back and redo the education module. And it may also be that they get asked to do it sort of periodically as refreshers. That I suppose at first blush, that sounds like, well, there is an education policy, but it does seem like that's not necessarily working. We've seen cases and pieces of correspondence that And we've heard from riders who've talked to drivers that suggest it's possible drivers and some Uber staff as well maybe don't fully understand those rules or policies. One suggestion that we heard then for addressing that could be maybe the training should, instead of being a video or something that's kind of impersonal, maybe it would be better if it was delivered instead by people with disability directly in person maybe or something like that. We're not sure how practicable that is given how people move on and off the app, but that could be one way that you sort of could further emphasize to drivers the human impacts of these things. Maybe as well, the training could be designed differently. The Australian Network of Disability, who, as I said, are the ones that have drafted up some of this material, they're not an organisation that's led and controlled by people with disability. They're actually an employer-led not-for-profit that aims to help businesses comply with obligations, but doesn't necessarily have that driving lived experience sort of governance. So that's another alternative that we'd thought about as a policy outcome. But we'd also be very eager, and we'll probably ask this later on to hear any thoughts or suggestions that that you in the room have about what sorts of kind of education-focused policies Uber might adopt that would be more effective. We know the current system isn't working, but we don't necessarily know exactly what would, and we'd be very eager to hear suggestions. Now, something Uber has also tried is they have something that's called the Service Assistance Program that they've implemented quite recently, and that's where people with various sorts of disability needs, including using assistance animals, as well as other things like mobility aids, you can sign up for that and self-identify to Uber that, that's you. And if that happens, the Uber app will do certain things, including it will flag for a driver when you make a booking. It'll pop up a little message that says, oh, this person has an assistance animal and you can't refuse them. It's unlawful and against our policies for you to refuse a ride on that basis. It sounds like, again, it's another attempt to reduce these sorts of instances and to educate drivers. But the feedback we've heard from people who've signed up for that program has been mixed at best. Some people have said, often drivers will tell them, oh, I didn't see the pop-up. I didn't know it was there. It wasn't prominent enough. And other people have actually said in some cases they think it might have made the ride refusals worse because it's identifying ahead of time that they've got an assistance animal. And so a driver that wants to discriminate is actually equipped to do that more effectively, which is a real problem. That maybe leads me to the second piece of this policy question, which is about the enforcement side. And so really that seems like it might be the bigger problem, that Uber says don't refuse people, but it's not actually enforcing that in a way that's effective and making sure that drivers feel a need to do that. So the assistance animal policy says, I've got a couple of pieces of wording in front of me that I'll quote. Their policy says, driver partners who engage in discriminatory conduct will lose their access to the driver app. Okay, it says they will lose their access. But then later in the policy, they say, if Uber receives a plausible complaint that a driver partner refused to transport a rider with an assistance animal because of the assistance animal, following a review of the complaint, the driver partner can be permanently prevented from using the driver app. Now, you probably heard my emphasis there on the can, and that's actually a phrase you see quite a lot in a lot of their other policies. Much more so, they rarely say that they will be kicked off the app. Instead, what's said is they can lose access to the Uber app if they discriminate in this way. And so that leaves wiggle room. Uber can, but it's not suggesting that it's obligated to in those circumstances. Now, we've also seen then complaints and back and forths where Uber customer service staff have said that on their end, the process they follow is that if there's a complaint, they compensate the passenger. They give you some Uber cash, I think they call it, and they refund the ride. And then they say, well, if that happens, we remove the driver from the app. And then the driver is removed until they do the re-education module and they say they've read the policies. Now, they could do that straight away from what we hear. They could get kicked off the app and then immediately go do the module and say, yep, okay, read the policies, won't do it again. And then the driver gets access back. And then Uber says if the driver has a second confirmed report, the driver will be generally deactivated permanently. Again, that there's some wiggle room there that you've probably heard me emphasize. Generally deactivated permanently. And we don't know if that's happening in practice. So we at least have some suspicions that maybe it's not. There's at least two people that I've spoken to about this who've said they've complained repeatedly about these refusals, and they said that somebody with the same or at least a very similar name they've complained about multiple times, and that person is still driving for Uber and still popping up on their app, which certainly suggests that Uber has not removed them. We don't get any follow-up from Uber. If you make a complaint, and many of you may have had this experience, Uber will not tell you what happens to the driver. If you ask and say, oh, what's happened now? I've complained about this refusal. Uber will say they can't, normally because of privacy reasons. They say we can't reveal that sort of information. And that means that there's not a lot of accountability. And there's no public statistics on any of it. Uber doesn't put any information on their website or any other forum that we can find saying how many complaints they get, how many people have been removed from the app on this basis. So again, there's no way to see what they're actually doing. And that leaves us with the suspicion that maybe these policies are not being implemented as firmly as they could be or need to be in order to be effective. So again, we're very open to hearing different suggestions, but some thoughts we've had given to us about ways that these policies could shift would be to say maybe the immediate ban for someone who's a first-time offender, maybe they should be kicked off for a week, and it's a flat week. It doesn't matter how quickly you do the module, but you should be given a sort of a mandatory timeout from your driving. To reflect on, you know, those policies, and so it's sort of the driver sort of is made to feel that for a time. Maybe other people have said there should even be a one strike policy and say the moment you do anything like this, you're immediately one and done off the app, no exceptions unless it's sort of a particularly extraordinary circumstance. Another suggestion I've had put to me was maybe when a person makes a complaint to Uber, Uber could provide information about the state regulatory body, and state bodies can sometimes follow those things up. So you make a complaint and Uber says, thank you for your complaint. I see that you are currently in Brisbane, and if you want to complain about this, here's the Queensland organisation you can make a complaint to that might fine the driver. Or an even more sort of proactive way of doing that might be if when Uber gets complaints, Uber makes its own notification to the regulatory body against its driver. So it takes the responsibility away from the person who has been on the end of the discrimination and actually says that Uber will be taking responsibility for policing its drivers. All of those are things that we're very open to considering, but we'd be very keen as well to hear feedback that that you all might have when we get to questions about those different options. But one thing we want to stress we think is really important is transparency. We quite firmly think Uber should be telling us what they're doing about this and what those statistics look like so that we can hold them accountable for it.
Thanks, Mitch. The next part I'm going to talk about is, could refusals result in unlawful disability discrimination? So we're going to go a little bit into the law here, but try not to get too technical. And then we're going to talk about complaints avenues, including systemic complaints as well. But I just want, before I start here, I mean, in short, we think that the conduct of Uber drivers who decline to provide a ride because a person has a dog guide or an assistance animal would very likely be disability discrimination. But I also wanted to say that we agree with the premise of other speakers that we understand are going to follow us, that the burden shouldn't be on victims to rectify this and individuals to enforce better compliance with the law. However, there may be a role or a pathway for individual complaints to pressure Uber as a way of getting a systemic outcome, which is why we're going to be talking about some of the mechanics of making individual as well as representative complaints later on in this presentation. So the Disability Discrimination Act prohibits discrimination against someone on the basis because they've got an assistance animal. The law makes it really clear that discriminating against someone because of an assistance animal is the same as discriminating against the person who has the assistance animal because of their disability. Many of you will be really familiar with the definition of an assistance animal under Section 9 of the Disability Discrimination Act. And I won't go into that in detail just because of timing issues. But I just wanted to, you know, note the issue here about that we understand that there are complex issues about who and what is an assistance animal and meets the threshold under the law. But we don't, you know, consider. Yeah, anyway, I won't go into that in much more detail, except to say that you would need to be able to show that you have an assistance animal within the definition of the Disability Discrimination Act to take advantage of the law here. The Disability Discrimination Act also prohibits discrimination in the areas of goods, services, and facilities. And we consider it is clear that Uber is a transportation service and that the Disability Discrimination Act confirms that it is unlawful to refuse to provide a good or service to a person because of their disability or assistance animals, or in the terms or the way they make the service available to a person. Complaints could be filed or made against both Uber and the individual drivers for people who want to make complaints. We understand it is likely that people will find it difficult to obtain compensation from the Uber drivers themselves, and many people will prefer to lodge complaints against Uber rather than the drivers, and we're going to be talking about that later on. Also, one of the fundamentals of disability discrimination is that it can be direct or indirect, and the tests for each of them are complex. However, simply, direct discrimination occurs when somebody is treated unfavorably because of their disability. Indirect disability discrimination occurs when a requirement or a rule or a policy that appears to be neutral and the same for everyone, in fact, has the effect of disadvantaging someone because they have a disability.
So we've talked a little bit there about, well, what might it look like in the broad sense of, is discrimination happening in these instances? And as we've said, we think it's quite clear cut that at the very least, the drivers are acting discriminatorily. But there's a lot of Uber drivers, and we hear consistently, and we get this, is you don't want to have to complain about every single one, every single instance. It's long, it's tedious, it's exhausting. It doesn't necessarily change the system. It doesn't necessarily get the sort of compensatory outcomes. It puts the burden on the person who's experienced discrimination to do this over and over again. So instead, what we think is it would be much, much better to engage with Uber and make the policy changes that we think are needed. Now, this has been done successfully in other places, in the US particularly, and in some cases in the European Union, there's been examples of people bringing litigation to compel Uber to shift its policies and the way it works. The whole reason that there are these quite clear statements in Uber's policies already saying you should not refuse assistance animals goes back to a lot of US litigation, actually. From about 2015, there was a settlement where the National Federation of the Blind sued Uber under US law, and Uber settled it agreeing that they would make it really clear and they would take certain steps, which were certainly a step forward, even as they haven't fully worked, as we can see. More recently, there was a lawsuit in the US around a different kind of disability discrimination, around the way in which wait fees were being charged to wheelchair users who took longer to get into an Uber when it arrived because of their mobility aids. And in that instance, again, Uber was compelled by the lawsuit to settle it and to change their policy so they're not charging those fees in that sort of unfair way. So we think that litigation against Uber is an option that can achieve that kind of change. But it's worth saying as well that things like this have not happened in the same way in the Australian context, and that's partly because Australian law is different and it's not as straightforward that Uber is responsible. In particular, I guess the first sort of point that you hit as you start thinking this through from a legal standpoint is that Uber's documentation describes itself as being a payment platform or a payments facilitator. If you ask Uber, what kind of company are you? Uber's lawyers will say something like, we're not a public transport service, we're a payment service. The transport is something that the drivers provide you with. Now, that's probably not how we would think about what Uber does and where its responsibilities start and end. It's probably not what most people in the room think, and it's probably not what most people on the street would say. If you ask them what kind of company is Uber, they would probably say something different. They'd say something about the service being it's how you get places. They set you up to receive a certain ride. So there are ways, and there may well be ways, to frame the particular kind of service there in a way that makes it more clear from a legal standpoint that Uber should be liable. That's not something that's been tested or that courts have confirmed, but it's something that we're keen to explore and that we think that there is room to think more about. Another possible avenue where Uber could be responsible for this is what you might call sort of secondary or vicarious, sometimes like vicarious liability is a word that's used. You might be familiar with this in quite general terms, in the idea that businesses are responsible for things that their employees do. If an employee does something wrong, then a business is normally sort of required to stand behind that, unless it was sort of really outside of the employee's job. Uber's business model is very adamant, though, that their drivers are not employees, and that's backed up by Australian law has sort of supported that position in the Fair Work Commission and the Fair Work Ombudsman. So you probably can't say that that drivers are employees, and it's probably not right to say that they're acting as agents of Uber either, we think, or it would be difficult to make that argument. But something that we are looking into is that the Disability Discrimination Act has a wider net than that. It says that a person can't cause, instruct, induce, aid, or permit somebody to commit disability discrimination. Now, that's quite broad. Permitting sort of talks is more about, well, could you have stopped it? Did you have the power to stop the discrimination from happening and you'd let it happen? And there's some Australian sort of authority and precedent that suggests that there's a potentially wide interpretation could be taken. So there's a lot of nuance to that question. There's a lot of factors to consider about what does Uber know about the rates of discrimination? What do they know about the extent of the issue? What have they tried to do to address it publicly, and maybe things behind closed doors they've done that we can't see? They're all things that we need further information on, but we do think that there's room to consider whether Uber is responsible for permitting the discrimination in that way. Now, disability discrimination aside, we've talked about those kinds of discrimination claims. We also know that there are other legal avenues that might be worth exploring. We're discrimination lawyers, so these other avenues are not our expertise. One thing we would note is that it's been suggested to us there could be a consumer law angle here. Uber is promising to provide a service of giving you a ride somewhere, but if they're not actually providing that service reliably, if a third of cases get cancelled, then maybe they're not actually providing the service they promised. And so that might be something that we could look into further. One concern with that, though, is that if that was the avenue we took to hold Uber responsible, Uber might just be able to change its disclaimers or its fine print terms and conditions and you know, wiggle out of it without making the systemic changes we think they need to. There's potentially avenues by which we think that there could be pressure put by people seeking to lodge complaints and pursue legal actions against Uber in those sorts of more litigated ways. I guess, though, as you've probably heard from what I've said, we think all of those avenues are a little bit unclear or would be uncertain. You wouldn't be able to just sort of put in a claim and say, I have 100% certainty I'm going to be able to force Uber to do what I want them to do at the end of this. And so that means we also think that there are spaces where there should be law reform. Now, one particular area is in something called the transport standards. Some of you may be familiar with these. The transport standards are a legal instrument that comes out of the Disability Discrimination Act. And the transport standards basically set out where liability sits for various kinds of transport. They say that providers and operators of transport services to the public have an obligation to make sure that their service meets certain standards of accessibility. And basically, we think that the transport standards have been a really good idea, and they've achieved some good things for things like buses and trains and other kinds of transport. But they need reform because in a lot of ways they haven't been updated when they've needed to be, and they don't have quite the coverage they need, particularly with things like rideshare and sort of these models of transport that are more recent that have come in since the transport standards were written. So the current transport standards don't make it clear that Uber is an operator or a provider of a public transport service. The definitions are not clearly going to capture Uber. They might not. We think that the transport standards should be amended. Government should change them to say explicitly that this includes rideshare services. They might borrow from the US legislation in the Americans with Disability Act to say something like Uber is included as a business that is primarily in the business of providing point-to-point transport to people. As I've said, that seems to have worked in the US context. And so They could then specify particular things that rideshare companies need to do, like Uber, like Lyft or any of the others, to make sure that they're preventing this kind of discrimination against people with assistance animals and other kinds of disability.
Thanks, Mitch. I'm going to talk, this is really getting to the pointy end of things, about how people can make individual complaints against Uber and also representative or group complaints and some of the strengths and weaknesses of each of those approaches. It's quite dense and I probably, yeah, I want to be able to stick to time as much as possible. So I'll try and pull out the biggest points that we've got here. So many of you will be aware that if you've been discriminated against, that you can make a complaint of unlawful disability discrimination to the Australian Human Rights Commission. And you may also be able to make a complaint of unlawful disability discrimination to one of the state-based anti-discrimination bodies, like, for example, in Victoria, under the Equal Opportunity Act, to the Victorian Equal Opportunity and Human Rights Commission. But for the purpose of this presentation, we're just considering the Disability Discrimination Act. Many of you will also likely know that if you want to make a complaint, a representative complaint, a group complaint, or an individual complaint, you've got 24 months from the date the discrimination occurred. So that's from the date that you were refused a ride from an Uber. It used to be 6 months. Previously, it was 12 months. It's now currently 24. If you lodged a complaint after 24 months, it still might be accepted by the Australian Human Rights Commission, but you'd need to provide some sort of evidence potentially to explain why you were lodging it late. We want to give people some information about what kind of information will help a person to lodge an effective complaint against Uber and what you'd need. We think that you will need evidence essentially to support it and as much detailed evidence as you can find. So that means keeping records of incidences of when you were refused a ride. That will be helpful. And that's helpful. And I think there's people talking about this later on tomorrow potentially, but even if you don't want to bring a complaint yourself, having this information could be used to support another person who has a case or a broader campaign. The kinds of records that you might want to keep include taking notes, so written notes or electronic notes about what happened, or a voice note about what happened to you and what happened when you refused the ride. You know, for example, including if the driver said anything to you and what the driver said, and also taking screenshots of any communications between you and Uber or any complaints you've made to Uber. So just making sure you keep copies of correspondence and that you've got those available. So recently there were changes at the end of last year in December as part of the Respect at Work reforms to the human rights law that mean that key peak organisations like disability rights organisations may now be able to bring a complaint on behalf of a group of people or bring a case in court. So the law last year made a number of significant changes to how the Australian Human Rights Commission can tackle systemic discrimination and how human rights and unlawful discrimination claims can be run in the federal courts, and I want to talk about those. So this big one that representative bodies like advocacy groups or human rights organisations or unions can pursue complaints on behalf of people who have experienced unlawful discrimination is a really big one. Prior to this amendment, you could make a representative group could make a complaint in the Australian Human Rights Commission on behalf of one or more people, but if it didn't resolve, they could not go to one of the federal courts on behalf of that same group. So if you're up against a respondent or a company that didn't want to resolve the complaint, there was no further avenue. So this always meant that individuals were better placed to make complaints, even when the alleged discrimination affected a wide group of people, because they wouldn't have the standing to go to the courts. This new ability to make representative complaints may not be helpful in the context where complaints are made against individual Uber drivers,
You know, because each driver is different. And if you're making a representative complaint, you need to be making it against the same person or the same entity. So unless Uber could be found liable itself, going back to some of the things Mitch was talking about, relying on individuals to make complaints still might be something to consider, and there'd be a number of different strategies. As a lot of you will also know, when you go to a conciliation or you try to resolve your complaint at the Australian Human Rights Commission, there's not much you can do to force the other party to resolve the complaint there. They either want to settle on the terms that are acceptable to you or not. And if they don't want to settle, then the next stop is to go to one of the federal courts. I'm not going to go into too much detail about court proceedings today, except I want to mention some key points that are important to decide in deciding whether to bring a claim. And that grows to some of the broader strategy that the rights groups might want to consider here in individuals. So some of the benefits of litigation, if a case ultimately succeeds in one of the federal courts, includes that individuals may be able to obtain outcomes they couldn't in conciliation in the Australian Human Rights Commission because a court is making a decision. Successful cases can also create outcomes for groups in the community. So in this instance, if an individual did succeed in the claim in the courts against Uber of unlawful disability discrimination, the decision of the judge could place significant pressure on Uber to consider and change its procedures entirely. Cases can also test the application of the existing law and the limits of the law, and it may resolve a really successful test case here may resolve some of the issues that Mitch was referring to. And finally, public interest cases, even just by filing them, never mind where they go, can really help to expose poor practices, build community awareness, and place pressure on respondents. So that's why you see a lot of media at the point of time of filing a lot of cases in the courts, because it's a really effective advocacy tool. But there are also some significant limitations of court proceedings in affecting social change and particular risks for individuals who are going to bring the cases in the courts. So firstly, there's a huge adverse cost risk. So if you're an individual bringing a case against a company like Uber, if you don't win, if you don't succeed, you may get an order made against you that you have to pay Uber's entire legal fees for the case, and that could be in the hundreds to hundreds of thousands of dollars or more. We at PIAC, because we do a lot of public interest litigation, are experts in getting protection for our clients, so cost protection. So that's orders from the court or indemnities to ensure that our clients have limited to no cost risk in bringing the proceedings. It's also important to note that court cases take a really long time to run, and they require significant involvement from the person that's bringing them, and it can be really exhausting, particularly when you've got a lot else going on in your life. There are also limits on the actual orders a court can make. Usually, the orders will relate to the facts and circumstances of a particular case or client, and, you know, so they might make an order to say that, you know, in the instance of Joe Bloggs, who was discriminated against by Uber, that particular instance was unlawful disability discrimination. They won't make comments generally or orders. I mean, they might make comments, but they won't make orders about Uber's conduct more generally. So in and of itself, the court decision isn't going to be enough to create really widespread systemic change. There's going to need to be advocacy to follow the outcome of a case to push for change. As well. And also, these cases are risky. And so you need to get really good expert advice before you go to court. And that's really important. And make sure that you've got a really well-resourced legal team, because there's also the risk of making bad law. And, you know, that could be a disaster for advocacy groups if they don't feel like they're on good footing. We'd say maybe don't go to court. If you feel like you can build a case, and we're fairly confident that groups in the assistance animal dog guide community will be able to do that in this instance. But if you thought you couldn't, you would really steer away from that option. Sorry, I've got 5 more minutes. Is that okay, timing-wise? Oh, I've just seen the note there.
Yeah, we're a little over already.
We're a little over already.
Yeah, we might... Oh, I don't think that's on. We might have to wrap up fairly soon for questions.
That's fine. I just quickly wanted to mention two things I think that will be interesting. Class actions is one thing I really wanted to mention. You can do class actions in discrimination law, but they're rarely ever done, and very few matters have proceeded in this way. There are very particular criteria that need to be met for class actions, and again, the case needs to be against the same entity, so you would have to be confident you could have a case against Uber. And class actions are also really costly to run. They take a very long time to go through the courts, much longer than an individual complaint. So that's something I think for advocacy groups to think about in this space, because people may be tempted to run a class action, but it might be possible to get just as good an outcome by running one good individual or a couple of good individual cases, which will be quicker, cheaper, and maybe more, even more effective. So just really wanted to stress that point, that there's a number of options. I also wanted to let people know that the Australian Human Rights Commission can now make inquiries into instances of systemic discrimination. It's a new power. It also came in with the Respect at Work changes at the end of last year, and it gives the Commission much broader investigative powers, including the power to compel information, documents, and examine witnesses on particular issues that it didn't have beforehand. And it's something that people should consider, particularly because, as Mitchell said earlier on, you know, there isn't a lot of transparency about what Uber has here, and so maybe the Human Rights Commission would be able to assist to resolve the issue by at least obtaining a bit more information. So, yeah, look, that is really all from us today.
I want to wrap us up quickly as we go into the questions, just to say we've thrown a lot of things out there. It's probably apparent from at least some of the points we've mentioned that we are exploring pretty closely the possibilities of various kinds of legal action here, the possibilities of various sorts of systemic things, advocacy to government, etc., that could go hand in hand with that. As far as the specifics of the kinds of legal cases we might be able to bring, we can't say too much about that for reasons that are probably kind of obvious for, you know, legal privilege, and you don't want to show all your cards in public necessarily. But we are really keen, as we look into that, to know from you as well any thoughts you've got around what changes you want to see Uber make specifically, what ideas you might have, and other people we should be working with and talking to as we look at that, because we really want to make sure that while we can bring our legal expertise to the table, where we're partnering with the voices of the people who know best what the problem looks like and know best what the solution should be.
Thank you so much. This is not working. This is working. Thank you so much, Mitchell and Michelle. The roaming mic will be coming around now, so if you've got a question, please pop up your hand. And note that we probably have about 10 minutes. We might not get through all questions if there are a lot.
Okay, hello, it's Nicole here. So my question is, it would appear to me from this conversation that Uber is kind of trying to almost distance itself from its partner rideshare operators and say, oh, we're not sort of responsible for them, so what they do is off their own bat, so you can't hold us responsible. But the fact that Uber is prepared to give people credit or like, as sort of a way to say, oh, sorry, our driver kind of did the wrong thing by you, doesn't that kind of then lead to the idea that they are admitting a degree of liability? Because if they're not liable for what their drivers do, then why provide the credit? Is that an avenue to challenge them?
It's interesting. I don't know. I mean, we'd have to, again, consider that, you know, I don't think that would change the liability issues strictly under the law, in the sense that it doesn't impact the driver relationship and the contractual relationship between the drivers and Uber. And the courts have been very clear and definitive on those kinds of relationships. But what it does show, Mitch, you can also add to this, is that Uber does know that it has to take some degree of responsibility here, and they know that there's reputational risk for them as well, and that they know that it's a problem too. And you know, I don't know if they think
you know, it's hard to know what they're missing here. If it is that understanding of lived experience that they think that that will sweeten the deal and will be okay, or be something, but I don't think that it's necessarily something that would affect the driver-Uber relationship. But it does go to show that Uber does consider itself as providing a service to its customers, and that it's a broad service, and that is something to consider from a legal perspective, and that we're going to be looking at.
Yeah, my only thought on that would be Uber. It's very apparent when you start looking at Uber's legal documents that they've got very good lawyers. They've spent the money and the time to, and so I'm sure they have some commentary as to how they describe the $35 payment. That doesn't mean that, you know, you'd take them at face value, but I'm sure that there's there would be ways to argue that in different directions as to what the significance of that is. But it's certainly worth contemplating, and it is one of those pieces that suggests a linkage.
Hi, I'm Jason from Staple Working Dog. I have a question regarding the legal aspect of who is responsible. So you were saying that Uber, technically in Australia, does not have the legal responsibility because they're a payment platform. So the legal responsibility for the discrimination would fall onto the Uber driver. Is that correct?
Look, what I will say is it is much clearer and very easy to show that you could bring complaints against particular drivers. That's a very straightforward case. But if you want to bring a case against Uber, we're not saying it's impossible. We're just saying it's more complicated. And what we are currently exploring now is what will that look like, and what will the strengths of that case against Uber be? We want to find a way to cut through there, and we think that we will, but we can't. You know, we're not at the point where we can say to you how strong we think that will be or how likely that will be. But the drivers, 100% yes.
Okay. So I participated with local law enforcement in Toronto, Canada, in a very similar situation with this, where they set up an operation where we used some guide dogs and we called for either an Uber driver or a taxi driver. There was a refusal, clear refusal, and then the police enforced the law, and then those drivers were then had to go to court, and they lost in court. And now in Toronto, there's a very, very low incidence of any type of discrimination. So why is that not an option here in Australia? So should individuals, what I'm asking, get the name of the driver and sue the driver personally? Because wouldn't one court case that proves this set the precedent?
You can go after the drivers individually in some of these instances, and there are also state regulatory bodies that will fine the drivers individually. I suppose there have been single instances of that, and it hasn't shifted things, and that's partly, I guess, maybe word doesn't spread through the Uber driver community quickly enough, or it's not a strong enough deterrent. Mm. Thinking about, I don't know the Canadian context that well, but I suppose I would also say it's harder to get the police. In Australia, discrimination is typically a civil kind of matter, not a criminal one, so it's much harder to get the police involved in something like that.
We would never get law enforcement doing something like that in Australia, and unfortunately our discrimination laws don't have that kind of, this is why it's so reliant on complaints, which is one of the problems. There isn't that proactive enforcement mechanism. But, you know, you're not far off. Okay, you are on the right track. And, you know, if there were many, many people that made many, many high-profile complaints in the Australian Human Rights Commission against Uber drivers, and that was in the media, for example, Uber's not going to like that at all. The Australian Human Rights Commission is not going to like that, because they see a proliferation of complaints, and drivers aren't going to like that either. They're going to want Uber to take some sort of responsibility for them too. So it's definite and certainly a strategy.
All right, it's Tyler here, one of the guide dog handlers from Staple. Just a straight out question, is anything actually going to be done to enforce their policies, or are we going to keep having the same conversation all the time?
I think you know, that there's a lot of people, it seems like, just looking at the program here, looking at the working group that's going to be established, considering the work that we're doing, I think something will be done. It's just a matter of what is it going to take to push them to do it.
If you're asking whether Uber's going to do it just sort of on their own out of the goodness of their heart, I suppose I would be confident about. If you're asking, do we think that there's avenues to twist their arm or compel that, we think that there are promising ways that that could happen.
And we think we can see that the campaign for change is moving, and we certainly want to be part of any legal avenues for addressing that.
Okay, another American. So Uber is a platform based in the USA. Is that correct? The holdings are in the USA?
I think that this is maybe something we don't. Do you know the answer?
Yeah, well, there's actually a Dutch company that I think is at the top of the parent company structure, but they have affiliates in each different country. So I think there's one called Razia Pacific that's a significant piece of the corporate structure in Australia.
Okay. I think from the stock exchange anyway, from what their financial holdings are, they're a U.S. company. Why, as Australians, are we... So we have Black and White. That's an Australian-owned company. We have Yellow Cabs, Australian-owned company. The rideshare platform for Uber isn't working well. I know everybody wants to use it. Obviously, we can vote with our feet and not use that platform and focus more on our Australian taxi holdings in a legal matter, because I feel like, you know, when we're filing individual complaints, we have Commonwealth law, so we have the AHRC, and we have the DDA. And when you file a complaint with the DDA, it really goes back to the AHRC. So it's really just the Human Rights Commission we're filing through. And then when we go to Queensland, we have the ADA and the QHRC, which essentially are very complicated processes. Filing with Uber as a complainant does nothing. And when we file from the Commonwealth or our local state laws, it's not doing anything. So there has to be a better avenue to maybe be focusing more on our Australian taxi holding companies from a legal standpoint as a big group. Is that a possibility?
Look, for us, you know, we are mere lawyers, you know, and we, in the sense that we really want to do and support the work of what disability rights groups tell us to do. That's how we work. Taxis used to be a big issue that people came to us about. Now people are coming to us about Uber, which is why we've looked into Uber and how Uber operates in Australia as specific to anywhere else in the world. So we're not looking... We're looking at the American context and elsewhere, for example, but when we say we're looking at Uber, it's about how it operates in Australia. But, I mean, yes, these sorts of things would apply to Australian taxi companies as well.
So, for those in the room, it's Kirsten speaking. I was just thinking as well when that part about mentioning the consumer law. Now, I know it's not like discrimination law or anything, but it does sort of open the avenue to go, I feel, on sort of both those angles on discrimination and consumer, because technically, one, it's doing discrimination law because of course of disability, but two, it's like, well, technically you are a customer of Uber. So that's just my thoughts. And my other thought was as a suggestion for what you could do to sort of see if the policies are being enforced or to make sure drivers understand is, as you might have mentioned, that have that flat period of time off. But then say if the driver does it within, say, the first 24 hours, or even if they don't, they have to do the same, like just the quiz part, say 2 to 4 weeks after they've done the modules, so that way it enforces that they have to understand it because they don't get that video prior. That's just my brute way of thinking about it, though.
Thanks, Kirsten. And just a quick note to Michelle and Mitchell. We'll have to wrap up, so just a quick answer, please.
Sure. I think both of those are things we're happy to chew on. As far as coupling the consumer piece and the discrimination piece, I can't say too much about how we might run a matter in that instance, because it would be future and hypothetical, but it's something we've thought about. And as far as the sort of the time frames on the education, noted. It's something we'll keep thinking about, but glad to hear your input.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us here today and we're really keen for people to contact us or to be able to connect with groups that are working in the space moving forward.
Thank you so much, Michelle and Mitchell. That was an incredible presentation. So many things for us to think about.
This has been a Dog Guide Handlers Australia audio presentation. If you would like further information on Dog Guide Handlers Australia or like to listen to further audio, please go to our website www.dgha.org.au. Thank you. Do you always have to have the last word?